Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
The documentary film Join the Club is about the origin of the movement to legalize medical marijuana. And the filmmakers argued that if you follow this movement back in a line from where we are now, with medical marijuana legal in much of the country, if you keep going back, you will land in San Francisco during the height of the AIDS crisis. At the time, AIDS patients were wasting away. They were nauseated and unable to eat, so they were struggling to survive. And the film actually centers on one character in particular, a man who actually coined the term medical marijuana, a man named Dennis Perrone. He's a wildly eccentric character who, as the film unfolds, moves from being basically a dealer to a political force. Dennis smoked his first joint as a soldier in Vietnam, and he says it changed him. In San Francisco, he ran a kind of counter-cultural commune, and he sold a lot of weed. But when the AIDS crisis hit, everything shifted, and so did he. Here's the filmmaker, Kip Anderson.
The only thing that was really helping anyone was cannabis. And Dennis Perrone was at the forefront of this. And his partner, his best friend, his lover, his soulmate, Jonathan, had full-blown AIDS at this time.
Jonathan was beautiful. He was a beautiful man. He was so into his health and taking care of himself and what he ate and everything. He went from being this young man with all this energy to shrinking and getting skinnier, and then the lesions would start forming on him.
Dennis cleaned up Jonathan, his wounds. He changed his bedding. He took care of him.
He was passing away pretty rapidly. And the only thing that was keeping him alive, being able to eat, being able to live day by day, was by smoking cannabis.
It was offsetting all the side effects of the AZT and the chemotherapy and all the myriad of drugs he was taking that had severe side effects.
The early AIDS drugs, they made you extraordinarily sick. Number one thing that everyone complained about was, I can't eat, I can't keep food down. If you could not eat and keep on weight, you died faster. If you could eat and keep on weight, you lived longer. If you smoked a joint and you've gotten the munchies, what was the logical thing to do? Smoke more pot, and sure enough, people could eat. They gained a few pounds, and in many cases, those couple of pounds made the difference between them living or dying.
At this time, Dennis had already started a small club in San Francisco and starting to get some traction. And what happened is the local police, they raided his little club, basically where he was living as well.
It was about midnight and we were ready to go to bed when I hear a knock at the door.
I look out the peephole and it's like a sea of blue. Search warrant, coming in.
And I'm going down to answer. Before I get down there, a sledgehammer breaks the door down.
The door starts splintering, breaks open, and these guys come through with guns out.
They found 4 ounces of marijuana in my house. But what they also found was my very sick best friend dying of AIDS.
Poor Jonathan, who was on basically his deathbed, they put the handcuffs on his frail wrist and tied it to the bed frame as if he was going to go anywhere.
That night, we heard AIDS jokes, gay jokes. We were physically and brutally intimidated by these thugs who found 4 ounces of marijuana in my house.
Even though it was only a few ounces, Dennis Perrone at this time was essentially distributing hundreds and hundreds of pounds through the community of helping AIDS patients. Any of these charges, you know, if you add them up, it could be a maximum sentence of lifetime at that time. It was that bad what he was doing and that daring. And when they went to court, Somehow, Jonathan, who was literally weeks to months away from death, made his way to court and he testified.
Jonathan was very weak and he walked into the courtroom.
And when he testified, by accounts, it was so beyond powerful of what he said and how cannabis was healing him.
A sick person walking into a courtroom explaining to the judge that they needed that marijuana for themselves for their medical reasons. We'd never heard of that.
I was exonerated because 4 ounces of marijuana were claimed by my very sick and dying friend, Jonathan West. And the charges were dropped against me. 2 weeks later, he died.
Jonathan was 29. He's his baby.
When that happened, the combination of those events, almost feeling like you have nothing else to live for, so you can risk everything, this gave him fuel to be perhaps the most daring activist, let alone of the LGBTQ movement and the medical marijuana movement at that time, of any movement that I know of recent history going up against the government of California, which was run by Pete Wilson at the time, and then the entire federal government. And he did this not through aggression. It was more on the note of radical nonviolence and then with a massive dose of charm and humor. I met him in person. His radiance, when you were in a room, everyone knew where Dennis was. It was just this aura that was just expanded out. And it was one of love, compassion, joy, laughter. And it just radiated through everyone to the point where this movement, you know, it was like this flame that caught a bonfire, then just spread throughout California to all the way today as we know it, you know, where most of all states are legalized cannabis for either medical or recreation. And hardly anyone knows it's from this one daring, bold man named Dennis Prohn.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary Join the Club. It's the latest in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. The Film Center is going to be screening Join the Club next Saturday, not Wednesday like we usually do. The documentary is part of their Utah Queer Film Festival. We'll have some details here in a moment. But let's go back to the story of Dennis Prohn. Here's the director, Kip Anderson, again.
You know, many movements have multiple people who start it, but, you know, there's always definitely a combination. This one particular movement, medical marijuana, he came up with the term. Coming up with that term just transformed of what this plant is. And even people in the movement that was very part in getting to where it is now, anyone at that time, they say, yes, 100%, Dennis Prohn, he himself was essentially, you know, if not, you know, 80-90% of the way reason why we're where we're at today. And yet today, you know, I go to clubs and I ask the owners and they're riding their Lamborghinis or whatever, some of these bigger ones are flying in jets and these influencers, they have no idea where it came from. And the boldness and the rebelliousness of him and his motley cohorts, and that it came from the LGBTQ movement and the AIDS crisis in a very tragic time that birthed this incredible movement where he is now.
How do you describe your relationship with Dennis? I know you didn't know him really well, but you did know him some much. But I guess, I mean, people who are going to see the film will come to know him in that way. But for those who don't, give us a sense of what he's like. I mean, you mentioned it a little bit before, but say a little bit more about, like, what was he like?
Yeah, I was fortunate. Right when I graduated college, I, with someone who's a lot older, we started a business. And anyway, we long story short, we opened the first cannabis club after 215 passed in the Tenderloin in the worst part of San Francisco. We needed Dennis Prohn's blessing. So I was the one sent there to meet Dennis Prohn. And when you walk in the club that you'll see in the film, it is 4 levels of a giant building. Is a celebration of joy, laughter, music, and everyone was essentially dying of AIDS, but this was their sanctuary. And amongst this chaos and this beautiful chaos, there was a whirling dervish of energy called Dennis Prone, who would be laughing and singing and dancing around, and everyone knew where he was because you wanted to be by him. You wanted to, if you could somehow know him, and he would remember people's names. And it was a magnetic energy like I have never seen. And he gave us a blessing, and he was very grateful because we started the club in the worst possible place in all of San Francisco. So he said, oh, please, please, please do. You're going to get the worst of the clients. Because he gave – that's the other thing people need to realize. Though the club made a lot of money that all went back to the community, if anyone didn't have money, no one would be turned away. They would give thousands of dollars of medical marijuana every single day to homeless people. People just didn't have money. Because obviously insurance wouldn't cover it, and everyone was taken care of.
We should mention that Dennis died in 2018, but you were able to interview him for the film. Maybe mention how people will see him. His speech is limited at this point. He had a stroke several years ago. Did that pose a challenge for the film? It seems like in some ways you just sort of leaned into the fact that his speech was limited, and it still gave you a sense of who he was.
It did. There's a, when you watch the film, one of the best parts, if not the best, people, the very, very last scene of Dennis, and what he says. I don't want to give that away.
No, don't give that away. It's a brilliant end. Yes, you're right.
and this is something, he died months, 2 or 3 months after we did this. It's as if he knew his story was finally being told and he could rest in peace. But dying, he still had this humor, and we just felt it was so important. He could barely talk. His health was deteriorating massively, yet he still had his philosophy, his message, his humor, and you could still see it intact. And there was just something so raw and beautiful to hear him in his own voice share some of these stories, even though most of it, fortunately, we have. We have just incredible stock footage of back in the 90s that shows Dennis in his prime, and it's really great.
The film tells about Dennis's early life, and he says, in explaining what it was like, his sort of his childhood, those early days, he said the world was not what he wanted.
I went suicidal growing up. And I'm gay. All Jersey, me, everyone in the world, not what I wanted.
What did he mean? And say something about that early part of his life.
He knew he was gay very young, and he grew up in a time that he felt everyone rejected him. He got bullied. He did not feel like he fit in, and he felt very alone and that he was not a part of it. And when he went to Vietnam, he had his transition moment where he smoked a little bit of cannabis and felt some sort of spark within him that showed a different side of who he was to himself.
Say more about that moment. I don't want you to move on that moment because you really highlighted in the film. Someone says that this joint he has experienced with marijuana for the first time, it changed him. And he said it made him realize who he was. What was it about marijuana that did something to him? Because it came to define his life in some way.
Yeah, it was very powerfully. He doesn't get essentially, he was in Vietnam at that time. The soldiers he was with, a lot of drinking.
Alcohol was a war drug, and he didn't do that. And take a joint. That joint changed me. Changed my whole attitude. There was a spark right there. No one didn't realize it. Who I was.
When he first smoked that first joint, there's a self-reflection about, cannabis. And there's something that you just see a different perspective. And something opened up that I think was closed off. And then he saw just a different angle in life. And then somehow it just sparked his purpose, because I believe somehow he, almost saw in the future that this is medicine. At that time, people would say Vietnam, they're using it for pleasure purposes and having fun, but something within him of the deep, troubles he was going through it sparked a light within him. He saw it was more than just some recreational drug. It's something that can transform, you know, finding out who you are and where you belong in this society. And then soon after that, finding obviously it has all these incredible other medical benefits other than also some psychological healing ones.
So he ends up in San Francisco when he comes back from the war. And this is an important setting in the film. It's the context for what's going on is that city. Explain what that meant to Dennis, and I guess really the sense of freedom for a gay person like that at that moment in American history.
Yeah, San Francisco at the time, you know, there's so many, you know, between the hippie movement and just so and between this movement.
Yeah.
It's such a character in the film. It's like his co-partner. You couldn't have Dennis Prone without San Francisco. It just would not happen of anywhere. And this self-expression at that time and this liberation, this freedom and this excitement of, you know, anything is possible. It was perfect for what, and Dennis was not from there. He was from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And something about that synergy was just best friends. San Francisco meets Dennis Prone, boom, flourishing. From then on, it was game time, a blossoming of a community that grew, and self-expression and you know, finding that this cannabis was not only first healing for people in different elements, but then even before the AIDS crisis came in, people realized how therapeutic it was for different ailments. Mm-hmm. It was just a perfect, you know, like soil, if you were. Dennis Prone is the seed and San Francisco is the soil, and he got planted and it was perfect watering and the elements just.
Yeah, it's so interesting because he plays this role. He becomes, I mean, fairly quickly, this charismatic leader of this, basically this commune, I think is the way to describe it. And I guess it's his charisma that draws people in. I mean, there's the pot, of course, that's part of it. But it was also, you know, there was communal food, there was communal sex. I mean, it was this community that he had created, I guess.
Some people just have that it factor. And part of it is like, this guy is fearless. Back then, to do what he was even doing then, it was just incomprehensible. Even though it was San Francisco, it was still very, very illegal. Because not only was it illegal in San Francisco and California, it was federally illegal. Yeah. So when you have this charisma combined with humor, combined with just completely, you know, fearlessness with a purpose, that fused into one. And he was a good looking guy too.
Yeah.
It just created this just, you know, ball of energy that was just irresistible and just undeniable.
They were selling a ton of pot back then at this moment, as you said, when it was federally illegal, it was illegal in the state. So let's talk about this moment. Dennis is selling it in this sort of communal atmosphere. And then this moment comes when they get raided and Dennis gets shot. This is another sort of turning point, it seems, in some way.
Yeah, this is a turning point. This is when the first time they get raided at the San Francisco, it's basically like a San Francisco loft. He thought they were being robbed because it was a very great with guns out.
The cops went in, charging up the stairs.
I heard a ruckus at the door, and I went to the stairway to see what was going on, and I see this guy coming up with a gun. The first thing I think, of course, that these guys are going to rob us.
He didn't know where to put the money. He gave me like $30,000, and I hit it.
And then Dennis picked up a water bottle and went to throw it.
But before I'd even got the bottle up, the guy had shot me. I was convinced that these guys were murderous ripoffs, that they were going to kill everybody in the house. The guy comes up the stairs and puts a gun to my head, and I'm thinking, goodbye, Dennis. Turns out they're all cops. Much to my surprise, they were taking me out of the house on a stretcher.
They went to court for this. They heard out in the lobby when people were talking that the cops said something very derogatory about gay people and said something like, it's a bad word.
They use the F word at this.
Yeah, the F word. Yeah. And that fortunately was heard by someone. They told the judge that. And when the judge heard that, they threw that out. And so then what started happening is Dennis was so savvy that he wanted precedence. He knew that there was such compassion, such sympathy, and knowing that this really does help, mm-hmm. that if he could get this to court and it could, he could convince a jury, which he would, because mixed with Tony Serra, I don't know if we're going to get it in, Tony Serra, the most incredible defense attorneys in history. There needs to be a documentary on him.
Yeah, let's talk about he's sort of a self-described hippie lawyer, Tony Serra, and he's a great character in the film.
He is a phenomenal one. I wish we had 30 minutes of just him. If anyone, you know, should look him up on YouTube. Yeah. By many accounts, he's the United States best defense attorney of all time. He's on 60 Minutes. He's featured. Anyway, he was Dennis Prohn's lawyer. And they wanted to take this to court. They wanted a jury. They knew if, you know, when you have precedence, that's forever. And so that's what he was so bold with, because he felt that if this does go to court and you have the right conditions, the right people testifying like Jonathan's and, you know, a lawyer like Tony, that it would start setting precedence and it would become legal. That's not the route it went. It went a different route, but that's his boldness where he wanted to take it.
One of the really interesting angles in the story also is the kind of political dimension. I guess it would be right to say that Dennis Prohn was taking a lot of this money that he's making selling pot and donating it to politicians. It's kind of like his own version of political patronage in some ways. Is that right?
Some would say Harvey Milk would have not. He would have not won. To his seat if it wasn't for Dennis.
Dennis brings me into Harvey Milk's camera place on Castro. At the time, Dennis was just starting to become very politically active.
My name is Dennis Prohn, those of you who don't know who I am. I just got busted in July. I ran the Big Top Pot supermarket over on Castro Street in San Francisco. I'll tell you, I'm tired of being busted.
My main ally was my good friend Harvey Milk, who was a friend of the gay community, who was a friend of the potheads. And it was just a friend of the people that had no voice.
You couldn't bypass me. You didn't register a vote.
We probably saw Dennis daily. Harvey would always say, you know, don't know where that money's coming from. But yeah, Dennis was a good contributor to our campaign, always in cash.
Dennis Prohn was funding Harvey Milk more than probably anyone. That's how much money Dennis Prohn was making and just giving it to him. Dennis Prohn, you know, even though he was a magnet, there was something about when money came to him, I think partly he knew that, you know, it could get raided anytime. Yeah. It would go on him and it would bounce out to other people. It would bounce out to people in need or to politicians. So he was definitely funding not only Harvey Milk, but this carried through the 80s and the early 90s. I won't go into detail of who, but like most things, there was definitely, scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. Hmm. He knew how to play not only the politics, but the media as well. And few know how to fuse that. You know, it's usually one or the other, but he knew how to do both of those phenomenally.
Kip Anderson, along with Chris O'Connell, he's co-director of the documentary Join the Club. The Utah Film Center is going to be screening the film on Saturday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of their Utah Queer Film Festival. We'll put a link to the details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. Harmon'sGrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a documentary that traces the roots of the movement to legalize medical marijuana. The story begins with an eccentric man named Dennis Prohn and his efforts to provide relief from the harsh symptoms of AIDS for thousands of patients in San Francisco. It led to a ballot initiative that made California the first state to legalize medical marijuana, and it marked this national shift that continues to spread through American culture. The film is called Join the Club. It's the latest in our film series. We're going to be screening the film with the Utah Film Center next Saturday night. We'll have more details here in a moment. We have with us the film's director, Kip Anderson. And the gay community in San Francisco at this time had so much political power and influence, which is really an interesting part of this. That seems to be something that you were interested in exploring in the film as well.
Yeah, we were interested. It's, you know, again, we talk about the medical marijuana movement, but as far as the LGBTQ movements, this is another one, very unsung, not only hero, Dennis Prohn, but such a massive part of the LGBTQ movement. You know, for again, we go back to Harvey Milk. Harvey Milk might not have ever been elected if it wasn't for Dennis Prohn. So you have this domino effect that really carries out to today of where we're at. We have a long ways to go, but still it comes back to Dennis Prohn. So that's the importance of him in history. That was kind of lost, that we feel this film is going to finally start putting a seed and it's going to branch out from here. And 20 years from now, he'll be spoken of a lot more in several different movements other than just the medical marijuana one.
Let's come back to the story that you told first early on about Jonathan. You talked about how Jonathan, of course, Dennis's partner, friend, he has AIDS. Dennis is taking care of him. And it's the marijuana, of course, that's providing relief. Explain what it was that that marijuana did for these AIDS patients and the difference it was making in their lives.
What it was, if someone has AIDS symptoms, you cannot put anything down. It affects your stomach more than anything. So you cannot eat anything. You can't keep anything down. What most people died of AIDS is malnutrition and basically starving to death. It's a horrific disease, and that's what it would do. And so cannabis would be able to people eat. And so, but then also there is a bit of disassociation with cannabis on the psychological effect that can really help with pain.
Yeah.
And I had a club, and I didn't realize the power of it until we opened it. And every day we had hundreds of people, and they would look right at me and say, "This is why I'm alive today." You know, I had an idea, but not until I was right there. I didn't realize how powerful that plant is to helping people. And then the other thing is cancer patients too. Yeah. It was 90% AIDS, but then the other 10% was cancer usually.
Tell us about Brownie Mary. She's another character in the film. Someone says you couldn't script a better public relations story. You have this granny helping AIDS patients by baking brownies with cannabis in them.
Yeah. Dennis Prohn, we saw opportunity, he seized it, he jumped on it and blew it up. And so it was just, again, everything was such divine timing, where they were at, you know, the location, the time. It was just meant to be. And Brownie Mary was literally a grandma who would go, she would volunteer her time and make brownies by night, cannabis brownies. And in the day, she would go to different hospitals and go to AIDS patients and feed them brownies and also do talk therapy with them as well.
Brownie Mary, as she's called by friend and foe alike, is in big trouble again, caught in the act of baking up 20 dozen marijuana brownies.
And I was up early baking. All of a sudden, six or five cops cars, I don't know, five, I guess, pulled in the driveway, and I looked out the kitchen window and I said, "Get up, Steve, I think we're busted."
Dennis got the word. I was here actually working the day he got that phone call and just watched. He picks up the phone and just starts calling reporters immediately.
He knew when that happened. I mean, he just, boom, as soon as he found out Brownie Mary was busted, he was like, "Get me CNN's number."
Until her arrest in July, Brownie Mary had been giving baked goods to a small group of AIDS patients free of charge.
So you felt you were a great source of comfort bringing those brownies?
Of course I was. Of course I was. And if I could get more, I would have made more. And if I can get any again, I'll keep doing it.
Even if it means that you'll wind up in prison?
I'll go to jail for my cause. You damn right I will. I'll go to jail.
You couldn't script a better public relations story than a little old lady who volunteers helping AIDS patients getting arrested.
I have been baking marijuana brownies to alleviate the pain and suffering of the AIDS patients that I deal with every day of my life.
Nobody else is doing what Mary's doing to help these patients.
It was the perfect story. And after that, it's almost like after Brownie Mary's story popped, it was no looking back, because her story was so truthful. When she spoke, you could tell, you know, the impact of what her work was doing, and that she said she would absolutely go to jail for the rest of her life rather than to stop doing what she was doing. Just an incredible, you know, Mother Teresa of the movement at that time.
In the film, there's, you document the kind of these different phases of the war on drugs that play out. I mean, it starts with Nixon, and then it really kicks in during the Reagan administration, and you explore that in the film. The film says that Dennis essentially is trying to, you know, work through the distinction being made between marijuana and other drugs in this, you know, war on drugs. And Dennis kind of creates this new way of thinking about marijuana, the idea of medicalizing it. Talk about the role that he plays in this part.
Well, that's what's so powerful is, you know, one of those simple things you don't think of much now, the word medical marijuana.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, it was like when those two words came together, it was a synergy that just exploded into this, wow, transformative what pot was back in the 70s and 80s. Oh, it's just to get high and laugh and munchies.
Yeah.
But when those terms combined into one, it had a lot of energy. And so combining that and then showing how it was medical, it was just incredibly powerful. Another thing, too, I do want to mention, you know, you mentioned about the time. And then just another thing I'd love to share about Dennis. Dennis, not only was he not fearless of someone coming at him, shutting down, he wanted it to happen. He went into the fire.
Yeah.
He, with Dan Lundgren, was the district attorney at the time under Pete Wilson. They were arguably the most conservative governor and district attorney in the history of California. And Dennis purposely antagonized Dan Lundgren. He knew that he needed a villain. He knew that he was the hero, and without a villain, this wouldn't work. And so we share that in the film. And, it's just, and he says this, and you know, when we interviewed him a few months before he died, he mentioned, he's, you know, it's giving too much away. He says, thank you, Dan Lundgren.
Right.
Because there was something about that polarization, that juxtaposition of so much energy, so much hatred, and so much something going against something and then it for it. You know, it's that thoughts become things. When you have that much energy, whether it's negative or positive, it's like the Madonna or Lady Gaga, you have energy. And so the Dan Lundgren fueled this movement more than he probably realized or wanted, but is an essential part of the legalization of where it is today, ironically.
Yeah, well, explain also, if you would, Dennis's contribution to writing this Citizens Ballot Initiative. This is Proposition 215. Dennis, if I understand it right, he basically wrote the thing.
Yeah, he wrote it and he made it vague enough that it could be interpreted in several different ways. And that was the genius of it. You know, when you see some of these, when you go and vote, you just read on and on. You don't even understand what it is. His purposefully was very vague and it left a lot to be desired. And what's so beautiful about that is, you know, it was difficult when it got passed because each city, not only did each city have to decide how to interpret it, each town, each little community within that city had to determine it. And that was the beauty of it. It's like, where do you live? Okay, do it resonates with my community of where I live? And if it doesn't, okay, then we can make it, you know, tweak the interpretation a little bit more conservative or more liberally. And so that was a beautiful way of how he made it, how he wrote it, all by himself, pretty much.
I think it's important to say that that you explore in the film not just the sort of positive viewpoint of Dennis Perone, but the questions that were out there about his, you know, the purity of his motives. And there's this moment where you raise questions about whether he, as some had suggested, whether he was, is he just exploiting all these sick people to, you know, make money selling drugs? You know, he was breaking laws, avoiding tax laws and insurance laws and building codes. Say a little bit about that, because that is something you do deal with in the film.
Yeah, we do. And it was interesting. While we were making the film, we wanted to be open. We went down that path of like, we need to be really open, because there are some accounts where it's like, okay, the big thing is, where is the money?
Yeah.
Where is the money? And so we spent like a few months of like, come on, like someone has got to know. There was millions and millions of dollars going through that. Yeah. And when we interviewed Dennis, you know, he died, it was like 4 or 5 months after. Those 2 or 3 months even working on the film, we were always like, you know what, maybe, because he's such a character, like maybe he does have 5-10 million buried in a, you know, somewhere. But he's living... Like, he's living in this, where we filmed him, in the same Castro house, very humbly, no sign whatsoever of having any money. And then he passed away. No one has any idea where the money is, other than everyone says he just kept giving it away. It's just, for him, it was about the excitement. It was about the life. It was about the purpose. And if he had money to do with it, he would just... It would be, he was all about the commune. He always lived with so many people and helped so many people out. It's not like he went on trips or even owned a car. So no one ever found the money. It was still to this day, no one really knows exactly. There's probably a lot of people that stole it amongst his inner crew, because he had no accounting, no banks. It was trusting people that sometimes he met for a week or two. He trusted everyone. You know, who knows who got a lot of it, but as far as we could tell, it was not Dennis Prone. He would just give it away instantly.
The question of whether or not Dennis was pure or a lawbreaker and exploiting people brings another character into the story in the film, and this is Joe Bannon, this police officer. Talk about the role that he plays in the story, because this is a complicated part of the story.
Yeah, it's a big part of the story. It's a cat and mouse game. And it's ironic because it was the first – Joe Bannon was the first policeman in the entire United States to come out as gay. He was featured on 60 Minutes. Yeah. And then he was the one who took down Dennis Prone. And he was led to believe by certain people of that Dennis Prone was doing this illegally and he was hiding the money. You know, so he had this these people in his ear that he believed. And he ended up going undercover into Dennis's club at the time that was having, you know, 10,000 people in the club. He was going undercover.
Officer Bannon, star 431. Today's date is 12-16-94, and I'm going to be making entry into the cannabis club.
There was an anonymous complaint sheet in my mailbox, and it basically said, you should look into the Cannabis Buyers Club. It's not really what you think it is.
Be a new member. I guess the years that know, right?
Yeah, I got it. Okay.
Todd, new member.
Yeah. Hi, how are you?
Doing good.
Walked upstairs and just kaboom.
Nice smell, huh? This is great. Oh, yeah.
Immediately overcome by the smell of marijuana, because people didn't just buy it, they sat and smoked it.
How you doing?
Good.
How are you?
Good.
A friend of mine, Ed, used to be a new member today.
Hi, Ed.
Nice
to
meet you.
Yeah, cool meeting you.
Nice to meet
you. You going to join our club?
Yeah, sure am.
Do you have a letter of diagnosis?
Anytime I saw Dennis, he was always stoned.
I should have never eaten that banana bread. I'm really stoned. Half my brain is gone.
Pay cash, you get a bag. You could buy edibles. They sold tinctures. I would sit down on the couch and start to get in a conversation. I said, man, that looks like some good shit, bro. You got something wrong with your body? You're sick? You know, what's the matter with you? I mean, I'm here because I'm f***ed up from the floor up, man. I got all kinds of shit. How'd you get your membership, man?
Well, now your official member is your first official buy.
Every sale was a felony. Every possession was at least a misdemeanor unless it was over an ounce. Why can't we stop it now? How much more do you need?
Yeah, they saw a few kids that were in the club that probably shouldn't have been there. And at the end of the day, they didn't have too much on him other than that they were selling a lot of cannabis. And then it was a cat and mouse game of how to catch him. And, you know, I won't go into details. Definitely some fun things of Dennis was always two or three steps ahead of the entire operation. I mean, there's a couple really funny stories of just somehow Dennis knew. I mean, it's right out of like the Pink Panther. Or he just knew. And so he played them like he played the media, he played the government, he played the politics. And there was something about the impurity of Dennis that, you know, you have to have that element of not just all, you know, clean bells and whistles to do the daring things that he did. You have to have this, I guess you'd say, shadow side or darker side.
Yeah.
There was that of him. You know, he wasn't a pure person. There was accusations of, you know, maybe using people more beyond their, you know, what they wanted to. And, he, you know, he definitely had some things, but nothing that we found of anything atrocious. And, but, you know, he used these shadow elements, and I think he transformed them into light where it could have gone another way. He's a very interesting, complicated person.
Yeah.
It's definitely not all dolls and whistles.
Say a little bit more about Officer Joe Bannon, though, if you would, because he's so interested in, you know, law and order. You know, he's a gay cop in San Francisco, had been part of that community, but then he goes after Dennis Perone, and he's described as, you know, called a traitor to the community. What does Bannon say to that question of how he was this traitor? Like, what do you make of his response to all of that?
It took a while for him to agree to be in the film, and he makes the film, him and Dan Lundgren. And while we were waiting to interview him, we thought we were going to, like, get him, you know. We did not like him because everyone who talked about him, he was, you know, him and Dan Lundgren were the devil. They were like Darth Vader. Huh. They're the ones who took it down.
Yeah.
And so we were going into the interview with, like, not wanting. And then when we met him, oh, man, I just think of him now. He's such a sweet person. He had such, conflicting ideas now to this time. Again, back then he had someone in his ear saying, Dennis is an evil person. This whole thing is, you know, BS. You got to take him down. This is going to be the biggest bust in the not only California. This was historically the biggest bust in the entire United States. That's how much money was put into this one man. And so he got caught up into, like, you know, I'm going to be the hero to take down this man. And he kind of didn't realize connect to his community of what Dennis really was doing. He was more on the side of the law and the legal conservatives, ironically. And so when he did this, I don't think it really hit them until after it happened.
Bannon, he walked the beat in the Castro for many years and was very well known to the gay community. And it was very disappointing to the gay community. And it was very disappointing to Dennis and his followers that Mr. Bannon had betrayed them.
This is the thing that I find so disgusting about Bannon and all these folks, that they could stand there and that they could be so blind to the horrors and the suffering within his own community.
I see absolutely nothing about my sexuality that has anything to do with me being a cop. I'm telling America, telling every other police officer in the nation and in the world that you can just be yourself.
They were putting my face up on bus stops, traitor to the gay community, traitor to the AIDS community. I was thrown out of restaurants that I used to go to all the time. I said, we're not going to serve you anymore. People would walk by me on the street instead of saying, hey, Joe, Nazi, criminal, murderer, genocide. Okay. Got tired of the hate mail, got tired of the phone calls, got tired of the name calling, got tired of the death threats, just got tired of rejection. It's like you don't even know the story, man. You feel like you're a bad guy after a while. Like, you know, you feel like you're the criminal, you're the bad guy.
And it was so sad because, you know, this community, he was a hero to them because he was on 60 Minutes as the first openly gay policeman.
Yeah.
And it was really tough to see because, you know, he's a really beautiful man now today and so sweet. And so it was a complicated thing, but quite the story with him.
That's the filmmaker Kip Anderson, along with Chris O'Connell. He co-directed the documentary Join the Club. You can join us for a screening of the film this Saturday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We have details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Kip Anderson. He's the co-director of the film Join the Club. This is the next installment in our documentary series. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening the film Saturday night, and it tells the story of how the push to provide relief for AIDS patients alongside the energy of the gay rights movement in San Francisco marked the beginning of the medical marijuana movement. So Proposition 215, you explore in the film the machinations that go into getting the signatures, the campaign to get it passed. Ultimately, it passes, and it passes by like more than 55%. In California.
When they said it passed, the world shook.
It does feel like we won.
The tears, people wept. It was amazing.
When the results came back, and we saw that we'd won with just about 56% of the vote, it was just incredibly galvanizing.
What was the significance of that for this larger movement, do you think?
The significance of passing by that large of margin was that this is real. And not only, you know, this could have been, say, in Rhode Island or, you know, some small state. This is in California. Not only is it in California, this is in California at the time where it was Pete Wilson, the most conservative governor, arguably, and Dan Lundgren. Like, this was a very conservative California at that time. And that's what really, like, whoa, this is a big deal. Then you had all the elements of the AIDS crisis of seeing real people getting, not necessarily healed, but living, being able to extend their life from cannabis. And so it put all the attention on California and then Dennis Perone himself. It put a magnifying glass on cannabis and medical marijuana as a term. So, it was all started from Dennis.
What happened to the Cannabis Buyers Club? I mean, I don't know how much you want to give away. It's one of those critical moments about the authorities wanting to shut it down even after 215 passes. What happens and what impact does that have on the life of Dennis Perone?
Yeah, well, that's another one. I won't go into too detail, but it was shut down, but it was something that the Cannabis Buyers Club, I don't think it could have sustained itself. It was so over the top, so chaotic, so lawless that it was a matter of time. So it was I was there. It was so sad when it ended. Everybody's so sad. But looking back, you know, it was very obvious that there's no way. I mean, it was a circus. And that was the beauty of it. And that was the other thing I want to mention too, that's being, you know, paid attention now a lot more of community in healing, whether someone's dying and showing how important community is. Not only was cannabis healing these people with AIDS and cancer, it was something about them being together, playing music and having, you know, these it was plays and dance parties. And that was probably, you know, almost 50% of it, where people could go be themselves and to have community and sharing with other people that are going through the same process as they have.
So Dennis says in the film, he kind of makes this bold prediction. Marijuana, he says, is going to be legal throughout the land. So I want to ask you, I guess finally, How do you think people are going to see this historical moment in the documentary? How are they going to sort of perceive it today? Like in Utah, one of the most conservative states in the country that happens to have legalized medical marijuana now, it just seems so – it seems to be what's happening. But seeing the battle and seeing how new it was back then, that's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, it's the goal of the film is to show the light on something that was, I don't want to say hidden, but just no one really knew, and to honor the roots of the movement and the compassion and the boldness and the genuine intentions of where it came from.
Kip Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kip Anderson, along with Chris O'Connell, he co-directed the film Join the Club, and we're going to be screening it Saturday, that's October 25th, at the Rose Wagon Performing Arts Center. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll have a link to the details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER90.1, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.